Hello, everyone, and welcome to part 3 of the Jacob Wetterling case. As a little recap again, part 2 started out at 4 days after Jacob's disappearance. As the days and weeks went on, investigators looked at Dan Rassier again. But again, nothing was found to arrest him on. Danny Heinrich is interviewed 2 more times, but denies having anything to do with Jared's abduction and assault or with Jacob's abduction. But then, in February of 1990, DNA from Jared's sweatshirt and fibers taken from Heinrich's car come back as a match. So Heinrich is arrested for Jared's abduction and assault. But it doesn't stick, and they let him go the very next day. Then investigators speak with Dwayne Hart, who again was a friend of Danny Heinrich's, and Hart tells them that he thinks Heinrich took Jacob. But the years pass with no arrests. Heinrich isn't arrested, and neither is anyone else. And then in 2003, Kevin comes forward. Remember, he's the guy who unknowingly drove through the crime scene right after it happened. It took him 14 years to come forward, saying the tire tracks they're looking at are probably his. Now let's get right into part 3. After telling investigators that he drove through the crime scene that night, they tell Kevin, "You know, we've been looking for the car that those tire tracks belong to for 14 years. I mean, sure, they can be annoyed with him or mad at him, but as I said, they should have known about Kevin from the very night Jacob disappeared because he did tell an officer." Now, once Kevin came forward with all this information, they pretty much throw out their theory that Jacob was abducted by a man in a vehicle. Remember, Trevor and Aaron said they didn't see a vehicle, just a man with a mask and a gun standing there. But authorities first thought the only thing that made sense is that somebody put Jacob in their car and that's how they got away so fast. If they would have been on foot, they should have found the guy right away, so they again abandoned the theory that involves a vehicle in the abduction. This again means Jacob's abductor was on foot, and to be on foot, again, he must have lived nearby. Now, who lives nearby that law enforcement already looked at? Dan Rassier. So a few months after Kevin spoke to detectives, now being early 2004, they call Dan Rassier. They ask him to come down to the sheriff's office. At this time, Rassier doesn't know why. He hadn't been a person of interest, not any longer anyway. He was maybe just on their radar, but that was it. When investigators spoke with him, they told him that they found the car that the tire tracks belonged to. So Dan says, "Great, you found the guy then." But they say, "No, the man with the car had nothing to do with Jacob's disappearance. We think you took Jacob." Remember, Dan called 911 the night of Jacob's abduction because he thought that those cops on his property with the flashlights were actually trespassers stealing things. They tell Dan, "You sounded pretty nervous when you called 911 that night." And then they say, "Why did you come outside to talk with the police that night? Was it because you didn't want them coming in your house?" And Dan says that's ridiculous. He can't believe that they think he took Jacob. During Dan's interview, investigators didn't change their mind about him at all. They just keep pressing him to admit to taking Jacob, but he doesn't give in. And finally, the interview ends and they let Dan go home. Now remember, Dan's a teacher still at the school. So a few weeks later, when Dan leaves school, he notices a car that seems to be following him. And when he gets home, there's another car. Dan tells In the Dark, quote, "I get out of my car and there's already a bright camera light. And that was the end of my life," end quote. This is when reporters begin prodding at Dan. They would constantly follow him and they knew his routine because sometimes he'd get to school, again where he worked, and there'd be a reporter there waiting for him. From this point on, Dan's life was never the same. People started to look at him differently, they didn't trust him anymore, especially not around their kids. After their interview with Dan, investigators started to put together the case they had against him. They say he was home alone the night Jacob was abducted, so he's got no alibi. And Trevor and Aaron said they didn't see a vehicle, so obviously the guy had to have been on foot. And they point out that Rassier was a music teacher at the school. He was always around kids that were Jacob's age. Now again, they have nothing concrete, nothing they can arrest Dan for. So they just keep tabs on him while the investigation continues, for about 5 years actually. Then in 2009, they actually have Patty Wetterling wear a wire and talk to Dan Rassier about the case. She kept asking him if he did it, but he kept telling her, "No, I didn't do anything to your son. I have no idea where he is or who took him. I'm sorry, but I don't." And then comes the 20-year anniversary of Jacob's abduction. NPR News put out an article on the 20th anniversary, which was October 22, 2009. It says the Wetterlings and their three children have learned to survive and cope through the years while never losing sight of the possibility that Jacob could turn up alive. Jacob's father, Jerry, says, quote, "That's the grandest hope, and it's certainly there," end quote. Law enforcement officials always get new leads on the anniversaries of Jacob's disappearance. Bringing it up again, even just once a year on the anniversary, seems to get people talking or thinking maybe they remember something from that day. Jerry Wetterling says, quote, "It just seems to trigger more calls and people kind of researching their memory," end quote. But he says they know they can't get too involved or carried away with one particular lead because of all the times they followed up with other leads that only ended up with disappointment. After Jacob's abduction, his friend Aaron, who was again one of the boys with Jacob that night, became so traumatized, which I think would be expected. He became scared of the dark, he didn't sleep, and he worried that the man who took Jacob would return. He told the St. Cloud Times that he would just lay in bed and think about these things. As the years passed, he says he thinks of how things could have been different. In an article from 2009, he says, quote, "That's hard for me sometimes. Why am I still here and he's not?" end quote. And the investigation continues. According to APM reports, on June 30th, 2010, investigators show up to Dan Rassier's farm yet again. This time, they have a search warrant to dig up his farm in search of Jacob or any evidence they can find that could lead them to Jacob. For 2 days, they dug up his property. The first day, they came with backhoes to dig up ash and dirt from where the family would dump their ashes from the wood-burning stove. They removed 6 dump truck loads of dirt. The second day, they searched inside the home. According to APM reports, they actually pushed Dan's 85-year-old father to the side, making their way into the home. Dan even says he was worried his father was going to have a heart attack. And they were even more cruel to his mother. He says his mother came up from the basement, not knowing what was happening. She sat down on a chair in the kitchen and asked them, "What's going on?" An officer went over to her, grabbed her by the arm, pulled her off of the chair, and drug her across the kitchen, saying, "You're all under arrest." But guess what? No one was arrested. And their search? Yeah, didn't find anything either. Again. But yet, that very day, the Stearns County Sheriff, the new guy, Sheriff Sanner, told the St. Cloud Times that Dan Rassier was now a person of interest. So, what's a paper going to do with that information? They're going to publish it. Now everyone in the community thinks this well-liked, well-respected teacher abducted and probably killed a child. But again, that search of his property came up with nothing. Even so, Dan had a hard time at the school. He still worked as a teacher, but it seemed no one wanted anything to do with him. Parents at the school even requested that a paraprofessional be present to supervise his classes. Then in 2012, Dan had enough. He wrote a very long letter to more than a dozen different government agencies and officials, including our then governor of Minnesota, Mark Dayton, and U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar. In the letter, he wrote, quote, "No innocent witness should ever have to go through what I have gone through with my family," end quote. But nothing was done. Investigators continue for a couple years thinking Dan Rassier was their guy. They never arrested him, but still suspected him of taking Jacob. A couple more years go by with no more leads, but then around 2013 or maybe early 2014, Jared Shirell sort of actually shook the whole case. So up until around this time, again, like early 2014, Jared still didn't know about the 8 Painesville attacks that had happened to the boys his age. So according to APM reports, Jared actually finally learns about these assaults through a woman named Joy Baker, who was a blogger that was interested in the case. And with Joy's help, Jared ends up pushing the case along. So hearing about the Painesville attacks makes Jared think that the man responsible for those assaults, his assault, and Jacob's disappearance is the same man. Jared thought, maybe I can talk to these Painesville victims, see what they remember, and we could figure out who this guy is on our own. And that's exactly what he did. He called one person after the other. After that, Jared and several of the Painesville victims get in contact with investigators. Jared tells APM reports, quote, I felt like I was Jacob's strongest hope, end quote. So investigators finally take a look back at the Painesville cases and Jared's case, and they take another look at Danny Heinrich. Now here's where things get moving in Jacob's case. It took for Jared, with the help of Joy, to contact these Painesville victims and to go to law enforcement again. So authorities still have Jared's clothes that he was wearing during his assault, and they have a hair sample still from Heinrich too. So they send Heinrich's hair in to get tested against Jared's clothing. And guess what happens? The results come back that his hair is a match. More than two decades have gone by, and Jared finally knows who assaulted him. It was Danny Heinrich. Now, the crappy thing with this is that the statute of limitations had ran out. There was nothing Heinrich could be charged with anymore for what he did to Jared. Jared was very angry when he heard this, understandably so. Now remember, after Jared's assault, his parents moved them to Painesville, where Heinrich lived and where those other boys were assaulted. So basically, Jared's attacker lived just down the road from them, and they had no idea. Now, even though Heinrich couldn't be charged with assaulting Jared, this was enough to get a search warrant for Heinrich's home to look for any evidence regarding Jacob Wetterling. Then, on July 28, 2015, they search Heinrich's home in Annandale, Minnesota, which is about a half hour from where Jacob was kidnapped in St. Joseph. His home is a small, one-bedroom house owned by his father. Investigators end up finding 19 three-ring binders that contain child pornography. They find a pair of silver handcuffs, duct tape, camouflage pants and shirt, and four bins filled with boys' size clothing. Heinrich was actually making his own child pornography using copies of a Painesville yearbook from the 1970s. So basically pasting these yearbook school photos of children on the bodies of naked children he found online. They also found many videotapes of footage Heinrich himself took of neighborhood kids delivering the newspaper, riding their bikes, playing on a public playground, and even at their sporting events. Some of the videos showed Heinrich placing a coin on a set of stairs in an apartment building. He would then secretly record as a boy saw the coin and bent over to pick it up. During the search, Heinrich speaks with the investigators and acknowledges he has child porn and states that some of the things they'll find are pretty damning. They also found recordings of news reports concerning Jacob's abduction and other missing children. On October 27, 2015, a criminal complaint is filed against Danny Heinrich. The complaint is for 25 counts of possession and receipt of child pornography. Now, they found no evidence of Jacob or anything that happened to him in Heinrich's home. Heinrich was in jail for almost a year while he waited for his trial to begin. But then, in August 2016, just 3 weeks before his trial was set to begin, Heinrich says he wants to make a plea deal. A deal for what? All he's got is child pornography charges. Well, he says he would confess to kidnapping and assaulting Jared and kidnapping Jacob Wetterling. I'm pretty sure everyone's jaws dropped to the floor when they heard this. So many people suspected him, and again, law enforcement had him in their grasp and they let him go time after time. And now finally, he's telling them, I did it, I took Jacob. For nearly 27 years, everyone has been questioning what happened to Jacob Wetterling. Where is he? Is he still alive? Heinrich says, I'll take you to his body. His body, so that just confirms everyone's fear. Jacob is gone. Now the plea deal is, in exchange for his confession, he would not be charged with kidnapping or murdering Jacob. And remember, the statute of limitations ran out for Jared, which would leave the child pornography charges. But the deal included that all but one of the child pornography counts against him would be dropped, and authorities would also agree not to ask him about the Painesville cases or any other crimes. So Heinrich would plead guilty to one count of child pornography, he would admit what he did to Jacob and Jared, and then he would serve 17 to 20 years in prison. He would be around 70 years old when he would get out. On August 31, 2016, attorneys, along with the Wetterlings, agreed to the deal. And Heinrich shows investigators where he buried Jacob's body. The site is on a farm just outside Painesville, not far from where Heinrich lived at the time, and actually about 30 miles away from St. Joseph, where Jacob was taken. One thing I know many people questioned is, why would the Wetterlings agree to Heinrich's plea deal? I mean, he took their son and wouldn't have to pay for it at all. Well, according to NPR News, part of it was because Andrew Luger, the U.S. attorney for Minnesota, says they basically had to act fast. Heinrich is very unpredictable. They needed to reach an agreement with him to answer the question, what happened to Jacob? Andrew Luger says, quote, Heinrich was open for the moment to tell us what happened. Danny Heinrich was ready to talk and we had to grab the moment, end quote. When investigators dug up the site, they found bones, teeth, and a t-shirt that read Wetterling on the back. They also found a red St. Cloud hockey jacket, which was the same clothing Jacob was wearing when he was abducted. According to the Washington Post, the day before Heinrich's trial, Patty Wetterling wrote a brief message on the Jacob Wetterling resource page, which again is the organization set up to help prevent child exploitation. It reads, "The Wetterlings are deeply grieving and are pulling our family together. We will be eager to talk to the media as soon as we are able. Everyone wants to know what they can do to help us. Say a prayer. Light a candle, be with friends, play with your children, giggle, hold hands, eat ice cream, create joy, help your neighbor. This is what will bring me comfort today." Now, something I personally remember from this case is this was all going on over Labor Day weekend. It came out to the public that they found Jacob's abductor, and now we know actually his killer. Now, I remember we were driving up north to go to the lake, and we drove through St. Joseph, and we saw tons of cop cars and undercover SUVs, and some of them were gathered together on the side of the road, and we were kind of like, well, this is weird, I wonder what's going on. So Jacob was again buried near Painesville, not St. Joseph, but he was from St. Joseph. So anyway, we get up to the cabin, and I remember the next morning waking up and my sister says, they got the guy that took Jacob Wetterling. And I'm like, what? What happened? How'd they find him? And she just points to the TV and the news is on. And I don't think we did much that day besides watch the news. We were all just in shock and couldn't believe that this was happening. Finally, everyone knows what happened. I remember everyone in Minnesota, at least Minnesota, turned their porch lights on again. Remember, I said we did that every year on October 22nd for Jacob's Hope, in hopes that he would come home. Well, everyone did it again on the night we found out what really happened to Jacob.